All right, I'm calling the meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today is Tuesday, January 30th, and the time now is 10:15 a.m. We're joined by Representative Armstrong, Representative Shragi, Representative McKay, Representative Wright, myself, Representative Rauscher. I am the chair of this committee. We do have a quorum.
What about me?
Oh, Representative Baker, I apologize. Representative Baker is here, and myself, I'm Representative Rauscher. So in the room, I don't see any other legislators at the moment. I would like to thank our House Record Secretary, Cheryl Cole, our LIO moderator, Zachary Lawhorn, and my committee aide, Craig Valdez, for all they do for this committee. Representative, I apologize, I didn't see you there. I'm sorry, my mistake. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all the members of the committee and people in the audience to silence their cell phones. We're joined by Representative Prox. If anyone in the audience today needs to pass a note to any of the committee members or committee members to their staff or somebody else in the audience, please get a hold of my committee aide, Craig Valdez. He will take care of it. If there are any questions, I ask that you direct them through the chair to the testifiers, any replies or any statements you want to make, go through the chair to the committee. Today, we're going to hear two linked presentations in one. The Alaska Center for Energy and Power will represent the Rail Belt Decarbonization Project results with lessons from Iceland. Due to the storms yesterday, some of the presenters were unable to make it to Juneau today. So presenting today in person will be Erlinger Gudlifson. Did I do that good? Okay, representative, Research Facility, Alaska Center for Energy and Power, otherwise known as ACEP, A-C-E-P. Joining us virtually will be Glenn Haldeman, Senior Researcher, Associate Vice Chancellor for Research, Innovation, and Industry Partnerships, University of Alaska Fairbanks, UAF. Steve Colt, Research Professor, Alaska Center for Energy and Power, otherwise known as ACEP, A-C-E-P, and Jeremy Vandermeer, Research Assistant Professor, Alaska Center for Energy and Power, ACEP, A-C-E-P, and Derek Stanklik, Founding Partner of Telos Energy Incorporated, and Matt Richtwine. I hope I didn't trip over your name too bad. Which one was it?
Well, I'm Steve Colt.
Oh, Steve Colt, founding partner of Telos Energy Incorporated. Due to the length of this presentation, I will ask that we pause every several slides and ask for immediate questions that someone may have pertaining to a slide, but any longer questions should be held toward the end. So, Mr. Gudlifson, if you would put your name on record, are you ready to begin?
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes.
We would, if at all possible, like to switch the order. We tried to communicate this with your staff yesterday, and they indicated that might be possible.
That's possible. Anything's possible in this room. I want you to know that. Okay.
So if possible, we'd like to do the ACEP Decarbonization Project presentation first, and in fact, that's the slide order, and have... I can't say his name either properly. I call him Eli from Iceland. Go second.
Sure. Sounds like a good idea. Now, are the slides on the screen ready for you?
They are, although I think we were attempting to make them bigger by opening an email.
Would you like to go to short at ease while we try to do that?
It might help everybody.
All right. Brief at ease. All right. We are back on record here. This is the House Energy Special Committee. So the presentation is now ready for us to view, and we're going to first be hearing from Mr. Steve Cole. Mr. Steve Cole, if you would like to put your name on record, give us your affiliation and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Colt, C-O-L-T. I am a research professor at ACEP, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at UAF. Thank you all, and thank you, Mr. Chair, especially for having us here today. We have a pretty big team that worked on this project, and several of them have, well, at least one of them has been caught in the vortex of air travel in snowstorms. Gwen Holdman is particularly regretful that she can't be here in person, and she has played a key role in this project, and as researchers, we are grateful to her for leading it and facilitating it. I also would like to mention that our principal investigator, whose name is Felicia Cecilio, did such good work on this project that she was hired away by Golden Valley Electric. So she is not able to present either as an ACEP, but I think what happened to her is indicative of the quality of the work, and we are grateful to her. Many of you know the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I will just read our mission into the record: develop and disseminate practical, cost-effective, and innovative energy solutions for Alaskans and beyond. We are very much an applied research shop. The project I'm going to talk about, with help from several colleagues who are on teams, is again called the Rail Belt Decarbonization Scenarios Project. And the goal was to try to look over the horizon at the year 2050 and ask the question, is it possible, technically possible, and if so, at what kind of ballpark cost to create a low-carbon electric grid for the rail belt? And we were particularly interested in looking at the reliability of this potential low-carbon grid in 2050, because we felt that this was a niche that was perhaps not being addressed by other research. Many of you are aware that other researchers have been weighing in on the question of Alaska's future electric grid, notably the National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL, and we have been coordinating with NREL, but again, we felt that a focus on reliability was something that would complement what they are doing, and also a looking farther into the future towards 2050, and also this project looked at a slightly wider array of technologies, and you will see notably later on that nuclear plays a big role in one of our scenarios. A final goal of this project, which is important, I think, for all to recognize, is that we set out to build our own capacity to do this kind of analysis at the university so that Alaska could have more homegrown expertise in this area. And I'm going to actually... Well, no, I'm not going to change the slide. I'll just say, leave it at that, that at least a major part of our funding was directed toward this idea that Alaskans can build up their capacity to understand our own energy systems and direct our own destiny a little better. We had a big team on this project, including several people from ACEP, a team from Telos Energy, and they're modest folks, but they are world-class consultants, and the reason that they're world-class is that they come from industry. They are not academics. They are industry-hardened veterans. We also had help from Information Insights with the major public involvement process and the Alaska Microgrid Group. This is Telos's blurb slide, and they may speak more to their qualifications when they begin their own testimony. I'd like to especially call out the fact that we, right at the beginning of the process, we went to our utility partners or our utility contacts, and we asked them point blank, would you like to be partners in this project? Are you interested in the questions? Will you help us? And the answer was a resounding yes, for which we are extremely grateful. And I think the people of Alaska need to know that the Rail Belt utilities were exceptionally cooperative and helpful throughout our process. They met with us almost weekly for 2 years, put tremendous amount of time and effort into it, and gave us invaluable feedback, all of which by design was technical feedback. We were not asking, and they were not trying to deliver policy goals or any kind of agenda for our project. They were helping us to try to get the system right when we went to analyze it. And this slide also acknowledges our major funding from the Office of Naval Research. Part of their funding came through our colleagues at the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute, for which we are very, very grateful. And part of our funding came from some FY23 appropriations from the legislature, for which we are also grateful. Turning to the process of this project, it was a long project, in part because a definite sequence is required when you want to study the electric grid. I think many of you have heard that the electric grid is the world's biggest machine. And I think that probably holds true in Alaska. Even though we're disconnected from the rest of the world, our grid is probably our biggest machine. And to study it to the point where you can do economic analysis, which is my field, you have to step through all these steps, including projecting the load, figuring out what resources might serve the load. A key step, which we will get to, is this Plexos step in the middle, where we try to see, can we serve the load in every hour of the year, not just on average. And then a detailed analysis, which again is relatively unique to our project, a detailed analysis of the reliability implications of bringing on what might be a very different mix of resources by 2050. And finally, we looked at the implications for the cost of service, which of course feeds directly into consumers' rates and bills. I think I'm going to skip the takeaways up front. You'll see this slide again at the end when it's appropriate to take it away. So moving on, we're going to go through these six or so steps. Most of the testimony will be from the people who led those steps, so I will get quickly into passing it off to them. I will speak briefly right now about what we ended up with as scenarios to study. And I'm not going to read any of the details on this slide. You will get to know the scenarios over the course of the next half an hour. They each featured what we might call an anchor tenant project, something that's big enough to provide firm, dispatchable power when the sun is not shining and the wind is not blowing. And those three projects were a major hydro project, a major tidal project in Cook Inlet, or a significant nuclear resource capability. We also have a scenario called business as usual, which provides a reference point by seeing what happens when we try to meet the load in 2050 if we essentially, I won't say did nothing, but if we continued with our gas-based generation system. So business as usual is in there as a reference point, and it also serves as a fossil fuel-based scenario for 2050. Before I leave this slide, I want to make the point and try to probably make it too many times that these scenarios are illustrative. These were the inputs to the project. We chose them somewhat arbitrarily, although you'll see some analysis went into the choices. We consulted with the public. We did a survey. And we also had to exercise some triage because we couldn't do everything that we wanted to or that we heard might be helpful. So they are illustrative, and they are by no means intended to be optimal, and we are absolutely not making any recommendations that any one of these might be the way to go. We even put in the QR code to our public involvement process, which got a little write-up of its own.
Representative Prox, you have a question.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I noticed that the words coal and geothermal are not found in there. Was that just triage, or is that coming up later?
I think I will let my colleague Jeremy Vandermeer speak a little bit to that. We did start out trying to look at geothermal, and we honestly couldn't find a candidate project that we thought was sufficiently advanced to go in here. So that's somewhat of a punt, representative, through the chair, but that's the way it is. And I think with respect to coal, I would characterize the treatment of coal as we didn't quite get there, because what you'll see coming up is that there is a significant role, even if you put in large amounts of renewables or nuclear, there remains a significant role for fossil fuels or something equally versatile and dispatchable. And so if you are really wanting to eliminate the carbon, it would be a fossil fuel system with carbon capture, and that certainly could be a coal. But as many of you know, there is at least one parallel study underway at UAF being led by Brent Sheets, looking specifically, I believe, at coal with carbon capture. So in some sense, we didn't want to duplicate that.
Thank you.
Okay, that was, for the record, that was Mr. Cole. Just so people who are listening know who answered the question. Now, I do have a question regarding Representative Prox's question. I was wondering, you began by talking about low carbon, and then it seems like on your answer you switched to carbon removal. And so I'm trying to understand, are we talking about low carbon, or are we talking about non-carbon now? So if you're going to remove carbon, then you're like, it seems like you're going to a realm of non-carbon, which I don't even think is available. But if you're talking about low carbon, I just want to understand how you mix those two when we talk about coal and fossil fuels.
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. And I will attempt an answer. I think at the very outset of the project, we wanted to inquire as to whether it was possible to aim for 100% decarbonization. But in our minds, decarbonization includes carbon capture and sequestration as part of the process. So it would count for us a coal or a gas plant with carbon capture would count for us as a low carbon or even a zero carbon resource. And to try to make this long story short, we quickly realized that it would be extremely difficult to get to 100% decarbonization. And our own internal dialogue and our project rapidly shifted to the realm of talking about low carbon resources. But I think for us, it doesn't matter whether the carbon is absent to begin with, as in wind power, or whether the carbon somehow gets removed from a fuel, either before it's burned or after it's burned.
Thank you very much for the answer. That was Mr. Cole. Now, I'm going to hold all my questions till later because I think they're going to get a little deeper, and I'd like to see you guys get through this presentation. So thank you. Anybody else have a question at all? Okay. Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Cole, and identify yourself every time you start to talk. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Steve Colt speaking, and I just want to briefly touch on the electric load forecast that we made for 2050. This is our load forecast ends up projecting almost a doubling of the load. And we looked in some detail at what is sometimes referred to as beneficial electrification, at any rate, electrification of electric vehicles, the addition of heat pumps, and we also tried to project realistically how much solar people might install on their own rooftops, so-called behind-the-meter solar, which affects the load that the rest of the system has to serve. And this graphic compares today's load in light green with the projections that we came up with, which again are almost double today's load. I think that it's important to recognize that this doubling of the load need not occur specifically through electric vehicles. There are other ways it could occur, notably, in our minds anyway, it could occur through one or more major industrial loads that might come on the system. But we wanted to look, we wanted to see if the system could handle such a big increase in load, because that might be a key to reducing rates, of course. And we wanted to see what it would take to serve that load. And so all four of our scenarios are, if you will, are tasked with the job of meeting a much bigger load in 2050. So we have a load forecast. We have the challenge in front of us. We got to meet this load. And the next step in the process was to try to come up with resources that could do it. And we have several scenarios, so you're going to end up seeing several mixes of resources. And I'm now going to turn the microphone over to my colleague, Jeremy Vandermeer, who led the resource selection and sizing task.
You might be muted still, Mr. Vandermeer.
Issues on our end.
We'll see if we can fix it on our end. Brief at ease. Okay, we are back on record. We're going to see if we do have ability to hear Mr. Vandermeer. Can you hear us? Can
maybe read that easy.
Do you want to go back?
Yes.
We're going to go back to Brief Disease. All right, we are back on record. The House Special Committee on Energy, and I believe we have Mr. Jeremy Vandermeer online, and he's going to be presenting from online. Is that correct? Can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. So, Mr. Vandermeer, if you would please say your name on record, and then also give us your affiliation and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Jeremy Vandermeer. I am a research assistant professor at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And Steve, could you go to the next slide, please? Thank you very much. So as Steve presented earlier, we had several different scenarios where we developed the scenarios. And so at this point in the stage, we are trying to determine each scenario had several anchor technologies and several different assumptions that went into what would be definitely included in that scenario. In this phase, we are selecting what else to add to each scenario. And so the first step is to identify which resources are available for the different technology types that we ended up including in the different scenarios. So we have hydro, wind, solar, residential solar, tidal, and nuclear. For each of these technology types, we included existing projects, facilities that already exist, projects that are being studied and proposed to be built. And then we also added a few ourselves based on resources, studying different resources availability to flesh out and develop full portfolios of projects for a 2050 scenario. Steve, could you go ahead to the next slide, please? So for the sizing part of the study, as you are well aware, a very challenging task to try to answer what should we build, where, which projects, how big. And so in order to do that, we built a partial optimization that would determine the sizing and which projects to be built on the system. And so as we said before, we had predetermined projects. And so this included tidal, hydro tidal, and also the transmission buildout. We also, nuclear was determined to be included in the scenario with nuclear. But we did use cost to size the nuclear. And then again, just to highlight, these are partial optimizations. And as Steve said, not meant to be, there's a lot of input assumptions that went in that were not vetted by cost. And so Steve, if you can go to the next slide, please. Okay. And so, high level overview of the results. So we had four different scenarios, and each scenario had its own different portfolio of wind, solar, tidal, hydro, nuclear, also fossil fuel, and battery. And so as Steve emphasized before, fossil fuel still existed and was a significant resource in each of the scenarios. As we will see later, the total energy output from fossil fuel did go down quite a bit in each of the scenarios. However, the capacity, the total installed megawatts, actually stayed the same or went up in each of the scenarios. And that's because, one of our key findings here, so we had two key findings, takeaways from the sizing results. And the first is that wind and solar, across the different sensitivity analysis and for the cost, projections that we had were consistently the cheapest sources of energy on the system, with the caveat that the amount that you can put on the system cost-effectively is limited, and this is largely due to the cost of curtailment. And so as you start to install more and more during moments of high production, you need to curtail or not use some of that wind or solar energy. And that energy that you paid for and that you're not using, so at some point that quickly becomes too expensive. And then there are also some additional stability costs that will be covered in the transmission analysis section. And so that leads to our second big point, which is that in addition to low-cost variable sources of energy, we need firm sources of power. Firm means that they can be relied upon to provide power to the system whenever they're needed, whenever it's required, at a very high availability rate. And so this includes technologies such as hydropower, nuclear, and fossil fuel, and to a limited degree, batteries as well. So those are the two main takeaways. And then I want to touch on nuclear a little bit, because nuclear, we had a scenario where we said, okay, nuclear, we want nuclear to be a big player in one of our scenarios, but we also wanted to because nuclear, the sizing is a little more flexible or more open-ended than some of the existing proposed projects for Cahuilla and Latana, for example, we wanted to kind of look at the cost effectiveness in terms of how much nuclear to be built and also where on the system to put the nuclear. And one of the results was that, and this is with the cost projections that we had, so there's a lot of caveats, and based on cost, nuclear was not competitive with LNG imports. And so that's just based on our projections. And so what we did in that scenario was we said, okay, we did not include LNG imports in that scenario. And so that meant that we had the, basically we had other, so existing cook inlet, new developments of cook inlet for natural gas or naphtha ended up being the next lowest cost sources of fossil fuel on the system. And again, we were not including coal in this analysis, and so that would be another thing to consider. But this achieved two objectives where nuclear, we had a scenario where nuclear was built and using the methods that we were using. And the second one is that we demonstrated a scenario where there was no LNG imports, and that can have other benefits and maybe of interest other than just purely based on cost. And so that was, anyways, I just want to highlight on some of the uniqueness of the nuclear scenario, and then again, touch on the cost, the final point where, you know, we want to say cost projections are uncertain, especially when we're looking this far into the future. And this is, you know, two different amounts for different technologies. Projections for nuclear and tidal are especially uncertain because these are much more nascent technologies. For nuclear, I'll highlight you're looking at small modular reactors or SMR reactors, which are a good fit for the rail belt in terms of size. But again, they are very nascent technology. So hard to project cost, lots of uncertainty. And we did run sensitivity analysis, which are in the report. So now I'll hand it over to Derek for the generation analysis.
I appreciate your testimony there, Mr. Vandermeer. We do have a question. We do have a question from Representative Armstrong. Quick question that she has for your testimony.
Thank you, through the chair. This is Representative Armstrong for the record. Just a quick clarifying question. You were exclusively looking at small modular reactors. Is that correct?
Representative Armstrong, through the chair, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
And anybody else have a question for Mr. Vandermeer? Mr. Vandermeer, I have one. You were looking at nuclear at Beluga. Is that what you said? And I was wondering, did you rule out the proposed coal plant in Beluga to do that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the chair, we did not look at new coal in any of these scenarios, and so we did not look at that. I think one. So as Steve mentioned earlier, and I think Derek can touch on a little more in some of his results, but nuclear and coal actually have very similar characteristics in terms of they're like a really good low-cost base load technology. And so you could, I think the scenario that has a large amount of nuclear in it, you could replace the nuclear with coal in terms of overall results. And it would probably end up being fairly similar, of course. In terms of cost, we don't know because we didn't really look at the cost of coal. But in terms of how the system operates, I think you would get pretty similar results.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much. Anybody else have a question for Mr. Vandermeer? Okay. So we're going to move on to...
Stensic?
Is that how I speak? Okay, Mr. Derek Stensic. Did I pronounce your name correctly? If not, could you please put your name on record for us, and we will and state your affiliation and then begin your testimony for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for your time today. My name is Derek Stensic. I'm a founding partner at Telos Energy and consulting on behalf of ASEP for this project, and I'll walk you through the next step of the analysis. Mr. Chair, if I might, could I address a follow-up on the question that was just asked to Mr. Vandermeer?
Yes, you may. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. I think you touched on that, but what I'll walk through in this next step of the analysis is really how all of these resources operate on an hour-by-hour basis. So I think the question came up about whether or not coal was addressed as a candidate resource. And I think Jeremy rightly pointed out from an operational perspective, some of the slides that I'll be walking through, we show some scenarios where nuclear was selected in the resource mix. And so we have a portfolio with a large amount of nuclear technology. I think from an operational perspective, you can consider the coal with carbon capture to be somewhat analogous. It's a resource that is intended to operate base load and operate at a very high utilization rate. And I think another way it's analogous is from a cost perspective. While we don't know the full cost of carbon capture sequestration, in general, it is a technology that is very high capital cost. So the upfront investment for the resource is high, but then the operation on a day-to-day basis is somewhat lower on a dollar per megawatt hour basis. And so if you think of the resources that we analyzed here, the variable resources like wind and solar, there's energy storage technologies like batteries, and then there's some of these baseload resources like nuclear, and you could view coal with carbon capture sequestration in a similar fashion as the nuclear resource. So now I'll, and just to confirm, you have slide 19, the generation analysis pulled up, or you move to the next slide, please. Thank you. So I'll talk through the next stage of the analysis. Really, we refer to this as the generation analysis, or what we're trying to do here is simulate grid operations. So very similar to the utilities, Tugatch and GVEA and Homer Electric. On a day-to-day basis, they're going through and operating their system in order to ensure reliability, to serve load across all hours of the day, and to make sure some of the constraints and operating reliability constraints are being achieved, and doing that in a least cost manner. So they're selecting for each hour of the day resources that meet the load in a least cost manner while ensuring reliability. What we do in this generation analysis is very similar to that process. We try to simulate that to the best of our ability. And the questions we're trying to answer is, how do we schedule these resources when we bring on variable renewable resources like wind and solar? How does that change the operations and the scheduling of the gas and the coal resources, for example? How do we manage that variability? How do we schedule battery storage resources? When should they charge and when should they discharge? And so we're walking through each hour of the day, each hour of the year, in a way that we minimize the cost of operating the system and ensure reliability. If you move to the next slide, please. So just talking through some of the inputs and outputs that go into that. So on the input side, we look at quite detailed inputs around the load across every hour of the year, basically when consumption is high, when it is low for electricity. We look at wind and solar. Again, these are variable resources. So depending on where they're located on the grid and what time of year, what time of day it is, they're going to operate very differently. And so we try to model the weather going through the system. We include things like the amount of water in the hydro reservoirs, whether it's the existing Bradley Lake or a new plant at Susitna-Wetena, for example. And then we also model, and a lot of credit to be given to each of the rail belt utilities for providing data on how their current power plants work. But we include information on the gas plants, the coal plants, oil plants that are on the system today in terms of how they operate, how they can cycle, the efficiency of those resources. And then we also include a representation of a lot of the operating reserves. So basically things that the utilities are doing to ensure reliability. They make sure they have backup generation available just in case there's an emergency on the system. So we put all those inputs into this production cost simulation. In this case, we use a software tool called Plexos. It's very similar to tools being used by the Railbelt utilities and really used by utilities and grid operators worldwide. I think as Dr. Cole mentioned earlier in the presentation, a lot of credit to the ASEP team. This is a tool that's being used extensively by grid planners around the world and something that now kind of they have the capability to use a very sophisticated tool like this in-house at the university. And then on the output side, things we're trying to get out of this are the operating schedules, but also the cost. So how this is going to feed into downstream analysis, we can use this information to calculate fuel costs, starting and stopping costs, and really inform that economic analysis. And we can also use it to screen for really challenging hours that require more in-depth analysis around grid stability and grid reliability. So if you move to the next slide, please. This is a representation. Now, this is showing the net generation from each of the different resource types on the system. And you can see there's four bar charts there. The one on the left is showing the business as usual, again, predominantly somewhat analogous to today's system, but with a higher load, and most of the generation coming from gas, natural gas resources on that system. Then you step through to the three other portfolios that Dr. Colt and Dr. Vandermeer spoke about. There's the wind and solar and hydro configuration. So here you can see wind and solar providing over 50% of the annual generation, a large component being from hydro, and the remaining a portion being served by gas. And you walk through the different portfolios. I think some of the commonalities here are wind and solar as probably the least cost resources from an energy perspective are constituting over 50% of the load in all three of those future decarbonization portfolios. And then there's, again, as Dr. Colt mentioned, those anchor projects, whether it's the hydro, the tidal, or the nuclear, making up a large portion of the remaining generation. And importantly, in all of these, there's still a role in these cases with the existing natural gas resources continuing to operate even in some of those high decarbonization portfolios. And so while their generation is offset and their fuel consumption is reduced significantly, there's still a role for the capacity to be there for reliability. Can you move to the next slide, please? So this chart really shows what the model is doing and kind of taking that annual snapshot that we just looked at in the last slide and looking at how the operations change over the course of a day. So at the top of these curves is one day, and you'll see the load kind of drop to the early morning hours, then up to a morning load ramp as everybody wakes up and starts to heat their homes. And then again in the evening as everybody returns from work, and you see the electricity load increase significantly in the evening peak. And now what you see is the different shaded regions in each of those days across the different portfolios is where the resources are coming from. You can see in the BAU or the business as usual, the natural gas is really following most of the load and kind of increasing its output during the morning and evening peaks. But you see in the three subsequent scenarios, you'll see the wind and solar is now moving around quite a bit, and that's the variability of the resources. And you can see how that displaces other resources. And importantly, on this winter day, you can see there's still a component, again, for those natural gas resources to provide some of the baseload energy there at the bottom. And you can see on the far right, the nuclear case where the large nuclear plant is providing that baseload power throughout the day. And then you can see at the top how storage at sometimes is higher than the line. That is when the storage is charging so that it can then discharge later, especially in the evening peak when that power is needed most. Next slide, please. Slide 23. So now I just want to talk to my colleague Matt Richwine. We'll pick up from where this leaves off. But we go through that entire process and we start selecting these individual conditions. So now we're looking at specific hours that we find that are challenging for grid stability or grid reliability. And we evaluate those further in some of the stability analysis, and Matt will pick up on that later on. But I wanted to kind of show how these dispatch select conditions are selected for future evaluation and subsequent analysis. Next slide, please. So this slide, again, I won't belabor it, but instead of showing one day, now this is showing one week. And you can see how that variability of the different resources changes from day to day, from hour to hour. And again, this process is repeated across each week of the year. And so we're doing this across 8,760 hours in a year to consider where which resources are providing electricity at which time, and how the different resources manage the variability of the wind and solar resources. Next slide, please. So importantly, in that assessment, again, we're doing that full 8,760 analysis. And the important thing there is when you think about that first chart I showed you, which showed wind and solar providing 50% of the overall energy on the electricity grid, that's not going to be 50% all year round. There's going to be times where 100% or more of the demand on the system is being served by wind and solar resources. There's going to be other times when none of the demand is served by wind and solar. There's just no wind and solar available. And so that's really the process that we're going through, is making sure that we can serve the load across each hour of the year. And then most importantly, when we think of these periods that have very high renewable penetration, exceeding 70, 80, 100% of the system load, we want to evaluate that in more detail in the subsequent transmission analysis. So that timing of the generation is really important. And again, my colleague Matt will dive into that further. And then finally, I want to, not only will the timing of the generation change, but if you go to the next slide, please, slide 26, the location of the generation is going to change significantly as well. And today, the Rail Belt utilities, there's three regions, kind of Golden Valley in the north, the central region with Matanuska and Chugach, and then Homer Electric in the Kenai. And today there is interchange, and it is important to have that electric power be able to transfer across the Rail Belt. But that will become increasingly important in this high renewable future. So the generation, where it is located and how it flows across the transmission network is going to change significantly, kind of regardless. One of the key findings from the report is regardless of which of those future portfolios get selected, the transmission grid is really a key enabler, regardless. And so what this chart is showing is flow across the network, the amount of power that's flowing between the northern and central regions, and sorted from highest to lowest. So positive numbers represent flow that's going from the northern region to the central region, and then flow, again, that's negative, is going from the central region to the northern region. The key finding here is if you compare it to the black line, those future portfolios are transferring power more in both directions. So there's times when Golden Valley will have to export down to Chugach, and there's other times when Chugach will have to export back up to Golden Valley, and there's a necessity for a much more dynamic grid in that future. And if you move to the next slide, slide 27 shows a very similar chart, but in this case, looking between the Kenai Peninsula and Chugach, or the southern and central regions. Again, same findings here. Regardless of that portfolio selected, just more flow across the network, and the importance of the interregional the transmission across the rail belt there. So that concludes my section of the presentation. Happy to answer any questions or pass it along to my colleague Matt.
The committee members have a question?
I do. I believe it's go back to resource selection and sizing. I still had a question, and it would be on the next page, where solar was recommended for Fairbanks, Houston, Nanana, Point McKinsey, Sterling, and Willow. So I'm just trying to understand. It's a pretty big area to run on solar. How much solar is that going to take to run all of that area?
Thank you. Derek Semplick, through the chair. Good question. And just to clarify, We're not trying to say that any one region is going to run exclusively on solar. I think you're referring to slide 15, which what we're trying to show here is the locations that we selected where there might be candidate solar locations. And so when we modeled the solar wind resources, it's important to understand the kind of the weather and the variability associated with that area. And so we simulate using historical satellite imagery on cloud cover and irradiance. We simulate the amount of solar production across each hour of the year that is likely to occur if there were a plant at any one of those locations. And so these are locations where you said, if there was a plant in Fairbanks, how would that operate relative to a plant in Willow? So again, not trying to say those regions are going to be served solely by solar. It's just that if you sited a solar plant there, what would it, how would it generate across the year? And so that location is just really important for first where it's located on the rail belt to understand the needs for transmission, and then as well kind of what the how the solar will operate from hour to hour relative to the other regions.
I appreciate the explanation. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee members before we ask them to continue with their presentation? Okay. Where are we going next?
Thank you very much. I will pass it over to my colleague, Mr. Richmond.
Okay. Matthew Richtwine, is that, did I pronounce your name correctly? And if I didn't, please correct me and introduce yourself, put your name on record, and begin your testimony when you after you give us your affiliation.
Yes, Chair, thank you. My name is Matthew Richtwine, and I'm with Telos Energy. And can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Please begin.
Great. I'm here to discuss the transmission analysis. This is the section of the analysis where we looked at the ability of the grid to technically serve the load and to remain stable and reliable through even more challenging operating conditions. On slide 30, briefly, what we are assessing is what we engineers refer to as steady-state analysis and dynamic analysis. Steady-state analysis being, can the grid sustain the operation in all credible grid conditions? And dynamic analysis being, can the grid recover from a certain a sudden shock, a disturbance, for instance, a lightning strike on a tower or tree contact or something similar? And the acceptance criteria is defined in the Alaska Transmission Planning Guidelines of some documents referenced on this slide. This is the same type of analysis that the Railbelt utilities conduct as part of their planning process. We're using the same software packages as the Railbelt utilities, and we received the models from the Railbelt utilities, which was a tremendous cooperative engagement with them, for which we're very appreciative. On the following slide, we start, we get into the challenges of why is this difficult? Why are we studying this, and why do we want to make sure we evaluate the risks here? From a steady state standpoint, we're looking at a lot of new resources, also a lot more load on the system, demand for electricity on the system from the load growth anticipated over this period. And it's flowing in different ways throughout the system. But from a dynamic standpoint, we consider the loss of a power plant where you have a sudden imbalance in the system which must be quickly corrected. The loss of one of the interties between, for instance, Chugach and Golden Valley, where it creates a sudden shock to the system, where it's expected that if those events happen and we plan for them to happen, that the system can survive either that loss of the power plant or that sudden separation of the rail belt. On the following slide, on 32, how we look at the grid is through resource technologies, which are now which are changing with the evolution of the grid. Conventional technologies, which we refer to as synchronous machinery, this is what you would find in your fossil power plants, nuclear or hydropower plants, have provided a number of stability services or support for the grid that we as an industry have been very used to over the 100 plus years of grid operations. That is evolving, and the other types of technologies, the other broad class of technologies are what we refer to as inverter-based resources. This is the interface between wind plants, solar plants, battery plants, or the tidal plant with the rest of the grid. It is not consisting of rotating machinery of a copper and steel machine as conventional plants, but it is more of a software-based electronic interface. And one of the a couple aspects of that is, one, it has a lot more flexibility and potential for enhanced performance than the conventional machinery, but it's in a sense a blank slate. It starts out as a blank slate, and that all of these supportive functions need to be enabled and put into the software code that underpins these technologies. On the next slide for case selection, tying into the generation analysis that my colleague Mr. Stenflick described, we are looking at not every single hour of the year, not as that would be intractable from just the kind of a volume and a computational processing standpoint, but we selected carefully the hours that we wanted to evaluate from a stability and reliability standpoint. And we wanted to select the most challenging hours of operation to test these disturbances and ensure that the grid can remain stable and reliable, and basically not to cherry pick or accidentally pick kind of simple or easy or conventional hours, but really to choose the hours of operation that are most different and most difficult to manage. In the understanding that if the grid is demonstrated to be stable and reliable in those hours, that the rest of the operation throughout the year would also be stable and reliable. In the interest of time, I would suggest skipping some of the detailed engineering analysis. I'd be happy to field any questions that come that way. But I would suggest going to slide 38, emerging technology, grid forming inverters.
Mr. Rich Twine, I have a question. We have, you guys in your presentations have talked about time of day. You know, if you have a solar and wind coming on at a certain time of day when they're not needed, it poses some sort of a problem about stability and times when it's actually needed as opposed to when it's not needed. So I'm wondering, have you guys done any research at all on net billing or net metering to understand which one would be less cost effective for the ratepayer, or is that something you guys didn't really get into?
Thank you, Chair. I would suggest that Dr. Colt is going to cover some of the economic aspects in the following section that I'd hope would be better address your question. If I may defer to him on that, either now or later.
No, we can go to him later. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for letting us know where to pose that question. Are there any other questions that the committee members have at this moment? All right. Please continue as you wish.
Thank you, Chair. Picking up on 538, emerging technology. And so I'll speak to what we found overall. Is that initially, so in these challenging hours, we were able to ensure that the grid does meet the Alaska transmission planning requirements through our modeling and simulation, following the best practices of the industry in terms of representing the grid with that equipment. And part of this was I want to highlight a particular technology that is emerging now known as grid-forming inverter technology. We identified this as instrumental to allowing to integrate all of the new technologies to very high levels where there are periods of time throughout the year in our future scenarios where we're able to operate the grid at or very close to 100% from renewable or inverter-based resources. And in short, what this technology is it is the industry latest combination, or essentially it combines the best of both worlds, if you will, of the conventional technology that I described, that rotating mass in those synchronous machines, with the best stabilizing aspects of conventional inverter technology that is making up essentially all of the wind plants and solar plants and battery plants that have been installed and are being installed currently today. This technology is commercially available today on battery, on battery-based resources. And on the following slide 39, while it is new, it is available today, and the industry has about 6 or 7 years of experience collectively where this technology has been actively keeping real grids with actual paying customers operating and reliable. And so we wanted to highlight this in terms of some of the promise that, yes, the grid is evolving, but also the technology is evolving with it. And this, in concert with transmission investments and transmission upgrades, we found to be successful in keeping the grid reliable, even in these future scenarios that we've modeled. As a means of wrapping up and passing on slide 41, I would skip one slide to slide 41, and say a few words about the process that this analysis has taken. In these charts, and apologize, there's a lot of colors and bars on this graph, but I'll take you through three major steps. From the resource sizing step, where we initially sized the different technologies, which is what Dr. Vandermeer spoke of, we would then proceed to the generation analysis that Mr. Stenslick described and ensure that there is enough energy to meet the demand at every moment in the day. And finding shortfalls in places, it could necessitate a revision to the resource mix. And so you can see, in this case, that would be augmenting with battery resources to help smooth some of the valleys and peaks and power generation and demand. From there, with the conducting of the transmission analysis, we would then look at the stability and reliability of the most challenging hours. And in some cases, we would find that the system was not stable or reliable initially. And so we would mitigate those through the use of the grid-forming technology, the emerging technology, as provided through battery energy resources. And so with the addition of some additional battery resources to help provide that stability and reliability, we would then augment the portfolio and consequently augment the cost of the proposed portfolio somewhat. That is the kind of the one-way trip, but really this process is naturally wants to be iterative, and there is a lot of optimization that could be done to revisit again the resource sizing and siting, as location of where these new resources are interconnected on the grid matters a lot for the reliability of the system and the investments required. And this could be revisited, and the team wanted to acknowledge that. Though there wasn't time in this scope to go and do a whole additional iteration on that. With that, that concludes my prepared material. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rusatoin. I was wondering, when you start talking about batteries, we're talking about an expense, but to what percentage is the expense when you're trying to talk about solar and wind being reliable? How big of a project is that? How big of a cost is that? And what percentage of the project is that to make that actually a realistic thing?
Great. Thank you for the question, Chair. On the expense of batteries, I think actually that leads up very well to the next section on economic analysis. And again, I would propose to defer that to Dr. Colt in his next, which should be covering next.
Sure. Well, I thank you. And then we do have a question from Representative Prowse.
Thank you. Through the chair, you've talked about reliability as being very important. It is, but it isn't necessarily the whole thing. I worked at a couple of different plants that are sort of little microgrids, but I guess to illustrate the point, reliability is of utmost importance to a hospital. But on the Fairbanks grid, the gold mine, the mill, has a lower rate, and they shed the load before they shed the load for the hospital, if they can. And maybe, well, the other day, the power went out when I was waking up, and I was able to get dressed in the dark, so it didn't bother me at all. But have you thought about, at some point, does load shedding come in as a something that might help solve the equation at a lower cost?
Mr. Richardson, please put your name on record, and if you can't answer the question, that's fine.
Hey, this is Matthew Richwine of Telos. Thank you, Representative Cross, through the chair. Yes, so load shedding is an important operational scheme, particularly used by Golden Valley, as well as all of the railroad utilities. And it was represented and modeled in our simulation analysis. Part of, when we talk about reliability and stability of the system, I'm primarily talking about maintaining the system completely, essentially not losing the system entirely through a collapse of the system on any of these events. That said, it doesn't necessarily mean that all customers everywhere would never lose power. Load shedding is an aspect of the model, and under the most severe operating conditions for the most severe disturbances, our model did show that load shedding would occur in order to save the rest of the system. That's been common practice in all grids that we've worked on around the world. And one further note on that, we did look at the levels of load shedding occurring as we navigated this evolution of the grid and the different technologies. And we did find that the emerging technologies that I described, the grid forming inverter technology, because of its high performance and speed of response, it was actually able to react really quickly and help basically rescue the system from collapse before a lot of load shedding became necessary. And so in that way, we're seeing where these emerging technologies have the ability to actually reduce the load shedding that would be required.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from committee members? All right, if you would like to continue on with your presentation to the next speaker. Oh, okay, he's in the room here. If you would like to put your name on record, give us your affiliation again, and begin speaking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Steve Colt again with Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I will be talking hopefully very briefly about the economic analysis. This is the last segment of our presentation, and I will try to go quickly so that we can get on to the final bullet on this list, some lessons from Iceland with our distinguished visitor. I'm on slide 43. There are basically two pictures that I want to share with you that, to my mind, summarize the economic takeaway from this project. The first picture shows the magnitude of the capital expenditures that would be required to implement these resource portfolios. And I will call your attention to really three aspects that struck me as particularly interesting. Or maybe it's really only two. The first one is the large amount of capital expenditure for the what I had labeled the anchor projects. That's in turquoise or, it's in turquoise, green, blue. It's the bulk of the capital expenditure. And so in the second bar on the left, that basically represents the cost of building Susitna. You may be wondering if these costs, if these capital costs are before or after application of the investment tax credit that is currently available under the Inflation Reduction Act. And the answer is we put in a 30% ITC reduction for Susitna Hydro, for Cook Inlet Tidal, and for small modular reactors. So there's 30% baked in there. I am aware of some of my colleagues and things I've heard that potentially Alaska could get a 50% ITC, at least on some projects. And so we ran sensitivity on that, but it's not in this picture. This is a 30% sale version of the capital expenditure, and it's a formidable amount of money. The scale is billions, so we're talking about potentially $12 billion of investment to do the wind, solar, hydro scenario. The second thing I'd like to call to your attention, and I think this actually it may help answer one of the questions from the chair, and that is the orange and yellow bars. These are the cost of batteries and associated equipment for grid support. The orange bar represents batteries that support and enable generation during normal operations. So, Mr. Chair, I think this may help answer your question. Unfortunately, I did not break out the wind from the solar here. Wind and solar are in green at the bottom, but the orange gives at least a ballpark sense of how much battery storage you need to add to the system to smooth out the wind and the solar, and in some cases provide reserves. I guess we could call that indirect smoothing out, reserves on the system that are ready to act if the wind and the solar do not go as the weather data might say they should. So the orange is to run the system, smooth the variability, and essentially play with the wind and the solar to make them viable resources.
So if I could, Mr. Cole, so between yellow and orange, I see about $1.2 billion.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's a big number, even though it looks small on the bar. They're all big numbers. Just to finish up, the yellow was of particular importance, I think, to myself and the rest of the team. The yellow represents the additional equipment that my engineering colleagues found to be necessary to keep this grid stable and reliable. And so it ties back to the bars on the previous slide where we were adding resources at each step of the analysis, and the yellow represents the resources that were added specifically to ensure stability and reliability. They are mostly batteries, but they could be, and even in our analysis, we we put in some other resources that appear to be a little bit cheaper and still do the job. But the yellow gives a sense, really, of the extra cost of reliability, and that was a key research question for us. Personally, my question was, is all this reliability stuff going to break the bank? Because it's something that is easy to overlook when you just start talking about wind and solar. Everybody says it's great. Everybody says it's cheap. But the real question, especially for a grid like ours, where we can't lean on our neighbors, we can't call up the Canadians for power, right? So we really have to make sure that these resources can work on our grid, and we wanted to see whether this yellow bar was going to be something that might be manageable or whether it might really be a showstopper. So and the numbers will have to speak for themselves. We're not trying to recommend or draw policy conclusions about them.
So let me get this graphs correct. We're looking at probably roughly 2.5 for wind and solar. This is billions. And then to stabilize and generate storage, we're looking at another 1.2. So that's 3.7 to do it with wind and solar. Is that what I'm reading, or am I getting that all wrong?
I think basically you're reading it correctly. I would have to say, though, that the orange and yellow bars, which are the storage and the stabilizing resources, those are needed to make the whole system work. And so they also help smooth out the hydro, and they provide reserves that might be needed because of the nature of the hydro. It's a big single chunk of generation, and so that brings its own operational and stability challenges with it.
So wind and solar only own a portion of that yellow and orange?
I would have to defer to one of my engineering colleagues, perhaps Mr. Richwine, to even attempt to answer that, because to my mind, the system is so complex, it's all commingled.
Mr. Richwine, are you still there?
Yes, yes, Chair. This is Matthew Richwine, co-host.
Did you hear the question that was asked? Basically, you're looking at the stability is in the yellow, the batteries are in the orange, and wind and solar are in the green. And the question was, do those together add up to 3.7 billion dollars, or does solar and wind only own a portion of the yellow and the orange that you have labeled here?
Chair, I'm
we're on slide 40.
Struggling to follow.
Okay. So, slide 43, we have colors there. You have the wind and solar generation, right? And you have yellow stability for grid support, and then orange for batteries. And it was established earlier that we needed to have those three things in conjunction to make them stable and to make them to have the storage for what is needed. So as far as the total number of yellow and orange, whatever that number is, looks like it's $1.2 billion. If it was wind and solar, the amount of wind and solar, is that only on a portion of that orange and that yellow? And to what extent does that portion pertain to just wind and solar? And if that can't be broken out that way, that's fine. We can move on. Maybe you can give us that answer some other time. I don't really want to stop the presentation. We're down to 15 minutes. So if you would.
Yeah, I would prefer to follow up with the
chair.
would prefer to follow up afterwards if that's acceptable.
You betcha. Please continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Steve Colt once again. By the way, I think that's an excellent question, so we hope we can answer it. I would now leave this slide, which is about initial capital investment, and it's a lot, up to $10 or $12 billion. And how does that translate to the cost of electric service that appears on your bill? Well, we looked at, I'm going to skip slide 45 because I, in the interest of time, think I can just lay it out in conjunction with slide 45. We looked at the cost to generate and transmit electric power, basically to get it to the substation, get it to the distribution system. We wanted to focus on this production cost because that's what varies among our scenarios. So in the business as usual scenario, the cost of service comes out to about $120 per megawatt hour in our under base case assumptions, about a lot of the inputs which I could go into, but I think you'll see that the bottom line is does not depend on any particular set of these inputs. So 120 is what the BAU is saying, and the other three scenarios cost a bit more. And the key takeaway to me is that we would be trading a very large expenditure on fuel. It's not in one of my slides here, but it would be under the BAU, it would be $750 million of fuel cost annually would be traded for paying off the capital cost of the investments. And also, something that surprised me, but I think it's very important, is that these renewable resources and the nuclear also, they require significant amounts of what we call fixed operation and maintenance. Every year, you've got to make sure this stuff is working, and that is a very labor-intensive process. So these sort of pink bars here showing fixed O&M, that is mostly labor and jobs for Alaskans. I see there's a question, so I will continue to pause on this slide.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, thank you. In your capital expense, have you included the depreciation expense, or is that?
Yes.
Or is that found in capital, or?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Prax. And since I gave a terse answer, let me try to just put it in a sentence. The capital cost in this slide, that part of the cost of service, is precisely what Representative Prax alluded to. It's depreciation and interest.
I see.
And we are assuming debt financing here.
Okay. Thank you for clarification. Please continue.
All right. I'm going to now skip four slides, which show in some detail what happens if you do sensitivity analysis and look at things like, what if the fuel cost was 20% higher? What if the interest rate was lower? What if the capital costs could get even better than 30% or worse than 30% investment tax credit? I'm going to skip those details, and you can look at them yourself. And I'm skipping to slide 51, which is the end of the economic analysis. Slide 51 shows what happens when you look at all four scenarios with 1, 2, 3, if you count the base case, 6 sensitivity cases. You get 24 different potential cost of service. And at this point, I think it's useful to take one or two steps back and remember that we're trying to look 27 years into the future, to 2050. We know whatever we're projecting. The only thing we really know is that it's wrong. And so my takeaway from this bar chart, this collection of bars, is that all of these costs are really in the same ballpark. And that's as much as I'm willing to say, wearing my economist hat, about these costs, given the tremendous uncertainty that is going into these calculations. So that really wraps up our presentation. I'm because we have a distinguished visitor from Iceland, I'm going to skip directly to his presentation. Of course, if there's any questions on this one, happy to take them. But otherwise, we're ready to go with the second part of our
I appreciate our show. That. And I do have one question, though. I'm wondering if you have anything to add on the intertie. What's your position on it? Do you have a position on it? And the capital expenditure scenario, and what's feasible, what's realistic? Do you have? Can you wrap up any, or is that not your job? Is your job just to present facts, or I'm trying to understand where the whole study ended up, saying this is the directions that we see you need to concentrate on, and is that a possibility at this point?
Mr. Chair, the short answer is that we are definitely not trying to make recommendations. We didn't even set ourselves the task of trying to come up with what some people call no-regret strategies, things that emerge that seem to look good no matter what else happens. But I can say this. We, in order for these scenarios to work, to make sense, in order to serve the larger load in 2050, we assumed that there would be upgrades to the transmission system. Basically, the planned upgrades to the southern intertie, the HVDC line from Nikiski to Beluga, and an upgrade of the southern intertie to 238 kilovolts. And we also assumed that there would be an upgrade of the northern intertie to 230 kV. Not a second circuit, but just an upgrade. Most of those assumed upgrades were in our costs. So we didn't just assume them out of thin air, but we packaged them into our costs. And I think this slide spoke for itself back when Mr. Stenslick was speaking, that the types of energy flows you see when you try to implement a scenario like this, the types of energy flows basically require the upgraded transmission system.
So basically you're saying that it's really something that has to happen before we could talk about going any further.
I think it's something that, and I'm maybe speaking out of school because I'm not an electrical engineer, but I'm going to say it anyway. My take on this is that it's something that needs to happen if we're going to carry through these scenarios in 2050. I think it's a very interesting question and perhaps TBD what needs to happen next.
All right.
It's a difficult question to answer. We did not set out to answer that question.
Do you have any idea on what's more feasible or realistic?
I would have to get back to you later.
All right.
After thinking about
it. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you being here, and I appreciate you all for testifying. I appreciate the presentation, and I do know we need to get on to the Iceland part of it. So if you would put your name on record, give us your affiliation, and start your testimony.
Dear Chair and others, my name is Erlingur Guðleifsson. researcher at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at UAF. I would be happy doing an research on Icelandic energy to try to see if those findings, key findings, could benefit the state of Alaska. There are three stepping stones that I would like to address here. I would like to briefly talk about the establishment of the heavy industry in Iceland, and later I would like to briefly cover infrastructure investment and then possibly lost opportunities due to lack of infrastructure development. Well, after the Marshall Aid came to an end, Iceland had to, you know, create a better foundations for its economy that was at that time mainly dependent on fisheries. So Iceland attracted aluminium smelters. And that goes along with quite a lot of hydro investments as well. If we wind a little bit back, forward in time, that ended up that there are three aluminium smelters, alloys, and data centers that more or less present our industrial, load intensive industrial sector today. And there is also, there has been this development policy of infrastructure investment regarding geothermal, and also what we did as to try to connect together the electrical islands that you could probably relate to as the state of the rail belt was before the interties and so on. So to look a little bit into, you know, there are Iceland generates approximately 6 times more per capita of electrical energy, and that surplus is going into the heavy industry, more or less. You know, the human consumption per person is relatively the same as we have here in Alaska. The length of the rail belt grid is similar to the Icelandic ring grid, as we call it. It goes physically in a ring, but it's more north-south here, if you can say so, the rail belt grid. And the population is ballpark the same. So we are talking about, you know, compared to other big electrical energy infrastructures in the world, we are talking about, you know, quite similar things in a way. So that what Iceland did in the after the oil crisis, when 50% of Iceland's electrical energy was generated with fossil fuel, they connected, as you see on the slide, there was those electrical islands presented with those yellow clouds. So there was this policy that took 12 years to implement to connect them all together. So you could move electrons freely from the generating regions that at that time were at the South Highlands. On this map, you can see north is up and south down, and et cetera, as usual. And that was a huge investment for the nation and eliminated at that time more or less the dependency of fossil generated energy. It increased reliability and almost blackouts, you know, are never heard of today. But, you know, this investment ended in 90, you know, this project ended in 1984. And there has been, of course, you know, some investment since then. There has been more heavy industry followed with more transmission lines and et cetera. But the ring grid, the capability of moving electrons freely around the island, has investment in that particularly has been lacking. And that is what will bring us to the, you know, the third key finding I want to address. That was this blog post for the CEO for the Icelandic Transmission System Operator, you know, the New Year's blog post. He posted out that because that the connections, we call intertie connections between the east of Iceland and south, we weren't able to move electrons from the east part of Iceland to the industrial region that is more southwest. So while it was a bad water year for the hydro reservoirs in the south region, they couldn't move electrons that were from in the east part of Iceland to the industrial sector in southwest. So they just had to use those reservoirs, and now they have to because of that, that was just flow over of the reservoir in the east. And now they have to reduce electricity, reduce power to the heavy industry with significant losses for Iceland. So I will try to keep it short. You know, we are in respect your time and all that. But you might wonder, you know, why should Alaska be looking into a case study from Iceland? And on a previous slide, I showed you the basic figures that we can see similarities, you know, but when you start to work with Alaskans, you see there are other similarities as well, and that is why we believe Iceland is a great, great case study to use as a reference for, you know, what can be done in Alaska. For example, you know, both those grids are, you know, isolated, fully isolated. Alaska is as isolated from the lower 48 as Iceland is island up in the North Atlantic. So, and you read the news here, you have the same news that, you know, the focus is to keep the rurals populated. It's the same that's going on at home. So there are both physical similarities and cultural similarities that we believe that we could capitalize on for the good of the state of Alaska. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I was just wondering, we do have similarities. At one point, the infrastructure wasn't there, right? And now you have some infrastructure to reach everywhere in your, whether it's commercial on the west or whatever on the east. So where did the funding come from to get you to where you are now? Did it come from international money? Did it come from private investors? Did it come from your own piggy bank at the state level? Or where did the funding for such a large undertaking come from?
Yeah. At the beginning, when the heavy industry was established, I think the World Bank and institutions here in the States, because the States helped Iceland quite a lot to try to develop the heavy industry, to try to put foundations under the Icelandic economy after the Marshall Aid came to an end. So that was, I think, international funding. Nowadays, there is at least all the transmission assets are governmentally owned, and most of the generation is, you know, the bulk of the generation is on the state as well. There was no private
co-ops.
No.
Okay. And no private electrician companies. Okay.
Yeah. Now the Icelandic transmission system operators, they fund themselves through, I think, European Investment Bank or something.
Okay.
But it's owned by the government, so there's a long credibility of the Icelandic government.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee members? Well, I found it fascinating. I don't know whether you have scheduled any time with my office or not, but I still have more questions. But appreciate the presentation here today. Time is getting pretty close to past when we usually end our committee session. So I do not see any further questions from the committee members, and I'd like to thank everybody again. All of you online, I apologize for stumbling over any name pronunciations, but having no further business in front of the committee, we are adjourned at 12:04.